content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled The Shape of Freedom, text by Jacoba Urist. In 1869, three formerly enslaved artisans started a stoneware business in Central Texas. A century and a half later, they've put their stamp on the art world. In 1856, the Reverend John McCamey Wilson, Jr., a Presbyterian minister and entrepreneur interested in clay science, relocated from North Carolina to Texas. There, in the Capote Hills, a rural, sparse enclave in Guadalupe County, 12 miles from the town of Seguin, Wilson opened a business called Guadalupe Pottery. Wilson mainly sold jugs, churns, crocks, and cemetery flower jars. The pots featured crescent handles and a deep chocolate-colored interior of liquefied clay. Before refrigerators and ice boxes, high-fire, non-porous pottery was essential to life, the Tupperware or Ziploc bags of the 19th century. Clay pots preserved everything from grains, beef, and butter to whiskey and even drinking water. The potters who worked under Wilson's direction mostly used alkaline glaze, one of the oldest methods in ceramics, to create a glassy exterior from a slurry of wood ash, sand, and clay. An arduous process in the 1850s, it took days to stoke underground wood-burning kilns to a high enough temperature for a successful firing. Three of Wilson's potters were enslaved servants who traveled to Texas with him, Hiram, James, and Wallace. For more than a decade, these men were responsible for nearly every facet of Guadalupe pottery's production. From mixing clay and expertly throwing the pots on a kick wheel to glazing and stacking vessels and meticulously controlling the temperature and duration of the kiln's flames. The men kept working for the Reverend even after Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1, 1863. In Texas, slavery didn't end until June 19, 1865, when Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston and issued General Order No. 3, informing the people of Texas that all who'd been enslaved were free, the event commemorated as Juneteenth. In 1869, Hiram founded his own stoneware business at a new site with James and Wallace. H. Wilson and Company, though not biologically related, all three took their enslaver's surname, a practice of some Black Americans at the time. Some scholars believe that H. Wilson and Company was the first business in Texas founded and owned by formerly enslaved people. A century and a half later, the pots they made are celebrated in the ceramics world. In silvery grays and greens, with uneven salt drips and textured glazes that resemble the moon's surface or sometimes an orange peel. Wilson wares are coveted both as objets d'art and for their extraordinary story of Black self-determination in the post-war South. Wilson pottery now resides in museums across the United States, from the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston, an indelible part of the country's entrepreneurial and creative heritage. The story of Hiram, James, and Wallace Wilson is woven through with threads of folklore, given the sparse records kept at that time, particularly for people born into slavery. But over the last 50 years, researchers have uncovered more details about the Wilsons. Georgiana Greer, a San Antonio pediatrician and ceramics collector aficionado, was passionate about locating abandoned kilns, and she left a trove of Wilson information behind, including a 1973 taped interview with James Wilson's son, James Wilson, Jr. Emancipation offered the Wilsons an opportunity none had ever expected. Establishing a pottery business was complex and costly. It meant finding a suitable site, testing clay, constructing a kiln, and hiring proficient workers. And the men did all of this in an intensely dangerous environment, said Ashley Williams, a recent fellow at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. In the late 1860s, black residents of Guadalupe County filed among 200 complaints with the Freedmen's Bureau for unpaid wages and violent crimes perpetrated against them. A Baptist missionary from Maine, the Reverend Leonard Isley, helped Hiram buy 600 acres of land for $500 and likely either gave Hiram a personal loan or served as guarantor in the transaction. When Hiram died in 1884, survived by his wife, Senia, and 11 children, Isley served as the administrator of his estate. One of Hiram's great-great-granddaughters, Laverne Lewis Britt, first discovered her connection to the Potters after her retirement, when she became interested in genealogy. Over the course of 5 years, she researched and wrote a book called In Praise of Hiram Wilson, which describes how her ancestor created a thriving post-slavery community in Capote. Hiram set aside 10 of his 600 acres for a Baptist church and became its minister. The white steeple chapel remains active today, besides a cemetery with cedar and crepe myrtle trees. Many Wilsons have been laid to rest there, including Hiram, whose grave is marked by a tall obelisk. Hiram also founded a one-room schoolhouse where Paula King Harper, another of his descendants, says her grandmother once taught. King Harper is the current president of the Wilson Pottery Foundation. On the phone, she described how interest in her celebrated ancestors' technique has spread into collector circles since the organization's founding in 1999. A pottery collector in San Antonio was at a garage sale and noticed the green salt glaze drip from underneath dirt that had dried on a gallon jug. They purchased it for less than $10, went home, cleaned it up, and guess what? A stamped H. Wilson. Finding that stamp is now the equivalent of finding a signed painting by a renowned artist. King Harper once sat in an auction that included several pieces of Wilson's pottery from someone's private estate. There was a beautiful, pristine 5-gallon jug I watched sell for $12,000, she said. Traditionally, clay artists, who make quotidian jugs and jars rather than purely aesthetic works, have been considered second-tier makers, ranking below sculptors. But over the last few decades, contemporary and historic ceramicists like the Wilsons are receiving new scholarly and art world attention. Williams, the recent Smithsonian Fellow, is researching the Wilsons as part of her doctorate at Columbia University. She notes that most enslaved potters wouldn't have been able to inscribe their names or initials on a pot. But once the Wilsons' potters were free, they added a maker's mark, which made all the difference. Future generations were able to dive into the records and find out more about the remarkable potters. Because we can tie the makers to these objects, which is so rare, it allows us to see the story about the resilience of the Wilson potters during slavery and their extreme success and survival, Williams said. The Wilson style may have been influenced by the works coming out of the Edgefield District in South Carolina, a place then known as a kind of pottery mecca. It was famous for massive bulbous jars and glazes, features from that the early Wilson pots share. Edgefield has its own significant history of highly skilled black craftsmen, including David Drake, the earliest known enslaved potter to inscribe his work. Later, the Wilson's pottery took on more distinctive features. The men started out using alkaline glaze, but once they opened their own business, they switched to salt glaze, likely for its strength and waterproofing properties. Salt glaze also produces more consistent colors and textures, such as the bumpy orange peel finish admired by H. Wilson and Company collectors. At the time, the method was uncommon in Texas, according to Michelle Johnson, project manager of the William J. Hill Texas Artisans and Artists Archive at the Bayou Bend Collection and Gardens, part of the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. And it was dangerous, she said, because salt glaze produces highly toxic chlorine gas from the wet salt thrown into the kiln during firing. For this reason, contemporary ceramicists avoid the method altogether. The Wilsons may have learned the technique from Isaac Suttles, an Ohio-born potter known for salt glazing, who was listed in the United States Census as living in Seguin at the time. Lid rims are another notable element of H. Wilson and Company's jars. At the first pottery making site during their enslavement, the men made more tie-down rims, jars without lids that require paper or cloth as a cover, which are easier and faster to make. Later, at their own shop, they crafted rims fitted for lids. Those lid rims allowed for more watertight storage, but they also required more sophisticated expertise. If you think you may have stumbled on one of these treasures at a garage or estate sale, look for a horseshoe-like handle, the most significant visual identifier of a Wilson pot. It's still unclear why Hiram, James, and Wallace switched to these thicker rolled handles from their original Edgefield-inspired crescents. It may have been because horseshoe handles are sturdier, offering more surface connection to the pot's body. That's another puzzling question that Williams is pursuing and hopes to answer in the future. It took a long time for the art world to discover the Wilson's creations. After Hiram's death in 1884, James and Wallace Wilson went on to work at another pottery site run by Marion Durham, a potter from South Carolina who had moved to Texas with John Chandler, who was most likely his enslaved servant at the time. By the time the Wilsons joined them, Durham and Chandler were in business together. That site closed in 1903. These pots remained in circulation, but many details of their story were lost. Decades later, an anthropology graduate student named Elmer Joe Brackner Jr. conducted a magnetometry study to find buried pottery. Clay contains iron oxides that can become magnetized. At the original Guadalupe pottery site, he found what's known as a groundhog kiln, a uniquely southern semi-subterranean kiln used in the 19th century for firing alkaline glazed pottery. At the second site, home of the independent H. Wilson and Company, Brackner found ceramic glazed shards in another groundhog kiln. His research and that of Georgiana Greer, the ceramic historian, helped piece together the Wilson's unusual story. After many years of advocacy by the Wilson Pottery Foundation, art historians and curators began scouring land deeds, court documents, and handwritten capacity marks, numbers that denote the volume of each jug, to present a fuller picture of the Wilsons, sometimes correcting previous theories about their methodology and timeline. Texas ceramic artist Erline Green researches the Wilsons' past while creating her own pottery to honor their legacy. In 2018, she interviewed Wilson descendants and collectors and visited historical societies in Texas for archival information. 2 years later, she curated an exhibition on her campus in Fort Worth. The show also displayed ceramic pieces she created based on the work of the Wilson potters. The narrative continues to evolve, due in no small part to proud descendants of Hiram, James, and Wallace. Every 3 years, hundreds of people gather in Seguin, Texas, for a jubilant 3-day Wilson family reunion that is open to the public. In 2023, festivities included the Wilson Pottery Foundation Gala and a 10th anniversary celebration at the Wilson Pottery Museum. The last reunion fell on the weekend of Juneteenth, and the reunion committee arranged a kickoff concert Sunday evening, followed by Juneteenth events in Seguin's downtown square. I was fortunate to grow up in Texas in the 1980s, around the time when our cousin Laverne Lewis Britt had uncovered the history, explains Deshaun McClinton Holland, the photographer for this story, and a Wilson descendant through his maternal grandmother. I grew up knowing bits of the story and visiting the church. He describes the process of documenting Hiram Wilson's legacy as a healing journey. To think he was born into slavery and was able to accomplish so much shortly thereafter, he says. It's inspiring and motivating to think of all the freedoms we have now and that we really have to push a bit harder. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Balancing the Scales by Cheryl Katz. In the Pacific Northwest, seals and sea lions have rebounded from the brink, but their appetite for endangered salmon threatens a delicate ecosystem. On a cold night along the coast of Washington State, two women on boogie boards paddle furiously across surging waters. Clad in survival suits and headlamps, Jennifer Savigny and Amanda Summers are heading back from a harbor seal gathering in Port Susan Bay with dry bags full of seal scat. A pair are biologists, employed by the Stillaguamish tribe of Indians, and they're mining the smelly, oily stuff for solutions to a wrenching conflict between some of the region's most cherished marine creatures. The flotillas of seals and sea lions plying Puget Sound today are a conservation success story. Because of their competition with fishermen, these animals were the target of state-sponsored bounty hunter programs in Alaska, Washington, and Oregon. By 1960, the region's pinniped numbers had been dramatically reduced. With the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, hunting them became illegal, and their numbers rebounded. But the salmon populations on which they prey plummeted. The causes of the salmon crisis include habitat loss to urban development and migration routes blocked by dams and roads. As cities have pumped water out of rivers, they also reduce the amount of water in the streams. The shallow water is warmer, and salmon needed colder temperatures to spawn and rear young. Climate change is also warming waters and altering weather patterns, disturbing both the freshwater and ocean stages of the salmon life cycle. With the Pacific Northwest once teeming salmon runs now just a thin trickle, the growing number of hungry pinnipeds have an outsized impact. Watersheds are out of balance, and the pinniped predation on salmon is a symptom of that, says Cecilia Gobin, a conservation policy analyst with the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, a consortium of 20 fishing tribes in western Washington. As the fish return to spawn in the rivers and streams where they hatched, bottlenecks like dams stir up pinniped feeding frenzies. The outlook is especially dire for Chinook, the largest of the Pacific salmon, also known as king salmon. Chinook are the centerpiece of the state's billion-dollar fishing industry. Washington allows both commercial and recreational salmon fishing, with regulations on quantity and size. Salmon are also a critical food source for many species of wildlife, including Washington's beloved and critically endangered southern resident killer whales. For Native Americans who have fished these waters for millennia, salmon are the backbone of their diet and culture. Salmon-related activities shape the vocabulary of tribal languages and drive the yearly calendar. The cycle begins with the return of the first salmon in spring, which Pacific Northwest tribal nations honor with the first salmon feast. Gobin, a Tulalip tribal member, says her people believe that the first fish is a scout for the rest of the salmon community to see how well we've been taking care of this place of the waters. The tribe honors the fish during the ceremonial dinner. We eat the first salmon with the community, and then we return his remains back to the water so that he can go back to his villages and report what he saw. If the salmon population collapses, she adds, everything stands to be lost. You're losing resources that are tied to the language and language that's tied to the land. The salmon's demise also threatened tribes' treaty fishing rights, says Pagan Frank, executive director of the advocacy group Salmon Defense. Frank's father-in-law, Billy Frank Jr., was a Nisqually fisherman and leader of the fish wars that culminated in the 1970s with Washington tribes gaining the right to catch as many as half the salmon in their traditional territories. Frank recalls when her husband, Willie Frank III, also a fisherman, would come back with many totes full of salmon. Now she says they barely even get one. She fears that salmon will disappear during her lifetime unless the pinniped population is controlled. How it gets done, she says, that will be interesting. Efforts to keep pinnipeds away from salmon have been underway for years, with little success. Loud noises, for instance, from firecrackers to high-pitched underwater pulsars, damaged animals' hearing, and sea lions that were captured and released hundreds of miles away just swam back. We're fighting an uphill battle, says Casey Clark, lead marine mammal researcher for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Because once an animal has figured out that there's a really good food source somewhere, it's incredible what it takes to get them to stop. In the Columbia River Basin, sea lions have scarfed down so many salmon that habitual offenders face lethal remover. This exemption to the Marine Mammal Protection Act targets sea lions that continually hang around and gorge themselves near the fish ladders, designed to help salmon make their way around dams and other obstacles. A long-standing limited cull was expanded in 2020 to measure the benefits to the salmon. Since then, 199 sea lions have been killed, sparing as many as 61,000 salmon, according to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So far, the program has promising results, with fewer sea lions lurking near the fish ladders and the outlook for Chinook improving. The permit, which expires this August, will likely be extended. The concept of killing pinnipeds to save fish draws fires from from animal rights advocates and raises concern about the broader environmental impacts. You're going to wind up with issues, says Casey McLean, executive director of SR3, which operates a nonprofit marine animal hospital in the Seattle area. The ecosystem is a web, and if you pull one string, we're not going to know what that's going to cause. That's why Savanian and Summers are out on their boogie boards scooping up seal poop. Managing an endangered species that is preyed on by another endangered species is a complex thing, Savanian says. The biologists are working with state fish and wildlife scientists, one of several collaborations between Puget Sound tribes and other agencies, studying ways to bolster salmon while keeping both populations healthy. While feasting sea lions can have a visible toll on salmon, less is known about the dining habits of seals. Fish bones in the scat will reveal how much and what type of salmon seals in the area are eating, along with genetic material showing the salmon consumed by individual seals. Preliminary results for the Port Susan Bay area suggest that seals aren't having a major impact, according to Savanyi. While other river systems may have different scenarios, it seems like salmon are not a really big part of our seal diet, she explains. The Stiligwamish are working on habitat restoration, rewilding former farmlands into cool, shady pools where young salmon can grow and strengthen before their arduous journey to the sea. Scientists from the Port Gamble Tsleil-Waututh tribe are also working with the nonprofit conservation research organization, Oceans Initiative, and an advocacy group, Long Live the Kings, as well as state agencies to test a promising new deterrent. The device startles seals hanging around salmon run obstacles and drives them away from the buffet. The underwater system, which emits short, random bursts that sound like nails on a chalkboard, is much quieter than old-school noisemakers and doesn't harden animals' hearing. But it distracts seals, buying fish just enough time to get through the ladder, says Rob Williams, a scientist with Oceans Initiative. In trials so far, Williams says, the device cuts salmon predation by up to 80%. For the salmon people, as the Pacific Northwest nations call themselves, the need to give fish a fighting chance is urgent. We only have a short window of time to recover salmon, Frank says. If we miss that chance, we will be the generation that lets salmon go. Next, we'll move on to an article in The Past is Prologue titled Country's Crown Jewel by Lindsay Kusiak. The vaunted radio program puts uniquely American music at center stage. On December 10, 1927, radio host George D. Hay announced the end of an hour-long opera program on Nashville's WSM radio. Next up was the much more down-home barn dance. For the past hour, we've been listening to the music taken largely from the Grand Opera, Hay ad-libbed. By from now on, we will present the Grand Old Opry. It was an inadvertent and fateful christening for what would become a cultural institution and eventually the longest-run radio program in the country, introducing tens of millions of listeners to a distinctly American-born genre of music. As Hay playfully commented, the Opry offered a stark contrast to other highbrow programs populating the airwaves, swapping symphonies and arias for jaunty renditions of old Anglo-Celtic, European, and African-American ballads played on the fiddle, banjo, and guitar. It was hoedown music, or as Hay lovingly called it, hillbilly music. And with the radio boom well underway, Hay had chosen an exceptionally propitious time to share it. Commercial radio fever swept the nation beginning in 1920, with more than 600 new stations emerging by the time the Opry premiered. But it was not only the barn dance on air, and Hay sought a way to make the show unique. He was known for his theatrical on-air persona, a mordant prude called the Solemn Old Judge, and he encouraged each new Opry band to adopt a comical, homespun identity that would charm working-class listeners. In the process, he transformed bands like Dr. Humphrey Bates' Augmented String Orchestra into the overall clad possum hunters, and other groups into old-timey miners or clumsy farmhands. As the Great Depression began, Hay's Salt of the Earth approach charmed the audience, while WSM made several ingenious business decisions that shaped popular music forever. First, WSM did the unthinkable amount of hemorrhaging economy, investing $250,000, $5.8 million today, to build a new radio tower. It was the tallest in the country and one of only three 50,000-watt clear channel towers in the U.S. It allowed WSM's broadcast to reach the whole nation. To bolster musicians whose record sales were plummeting, down from 100 million in 1927 to a meager 6 million in 1932, WSM began sending bands on regional tours during the week, creating one of the country's first talent agencies, the Artist Service Bureau. Soon, Opry stars were performing for as many as 12,000 people a day at schools or picnics Sunday through Friday before hustling back to the Opry for their Saturday night radio gig. In 1939, the Grand Ole Opry joined NBC's radio network, transmitting the show to 125 stations. It wasn't long before the Opry's successes gained a longtime sponsor, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, maker of Camel cigarettes, which sponsored a USO-style tour starring several Opry stars. Called the Grand Ole Opry Camel Caravan, the troupe appeared exclusively for military members and bases throughout the U.S. and Central America during the summer of 1941, charming soldiers with toe-tapping hillbilly music and comedy from Minnie Pearl. A few months later, following Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, millions of the same soldiers were now crooning the Opry songs on troop ships and in overseas barracks as they deployed in World War II. The show's new popularity among soldiers spurred the Armed Forces Radio Service, AFRS, to add the Grand Ole Opry to its overseas broadcast in 1943, transmitting the Opry's weekly show to 306 outlets in 47 countries. By 1945, an AFRS station in Munich reported the Opry superstar Roy Acuff was more popular among its listeners than Frank Sinatra. The show even triumphed in the Pacific Theater, where famed war correspondent Ernie Pyle reported that during the Battle of Okinawa, Japanese troops were chanting, "To hell with Roosevelt, to hell with Babe Ruth, and to hell with Roy Acuff." In 1943, the Opry moved into the Ryman Auditorium, the city's largest venue at the time. And still, the Saturday Night Showcase, featuring up-and-coming stars like Hank Williams and later Patsy Cline, Willie Nelson and Loretta Lynn, sold out each week. It wasn't until 1974 that Opry finally moved into its current home, a 4,440-seat Grand Ole Opry House. Today, the Grand Ole Opry has spent nearly 100 years as country tastemaker, elevating stars like George Jones, Garth Brooks, Johnny Cash, and hundreds more. Thanks to this hearty institution and contributions by crossover artists like Beyoncé, country music continues to dominate the streaming charts and in 2023 was declared the fastest growing genre in popular music. As country singer and Opry member Brad Paisley puts it, "Pilgrims travel to Jerusalem to see the Holy Land and the foundations of their faith. People go to Washington, D.C. to see the workings of the government and the foundation of our country. And fans flock to Nashville to see the foundation of country music, the Grand Ole Opry." We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.